Committee on Consumer Business Affairs, meeting April 23rd, 1907, here in Room F, it's 1 p.m.
Who would like to begin? David?
I will address 2916A-5. And I apologize to the committee for not making these amendments when I was in here before and having to take your time again today with this bill. I appreciate the chair's leniency in this regard, allowing me to testify again and submit these amendments. Most of the amendments, and you should have a hand in gross, as well as a copy of the Legislative Council amendments. Most of the amendments simply walk through the bill, for instance, on line 15 on the first page, subparagraph under section 1.3, insert crash on line 15 between if and parts. On line 18, insert crash between automobile and part. On line 19, insert crash between automobile and part. On line 22, insert between four and parts. On line 22. On line 3, we need to strike on the second page, line 3, subsection B, we need to strike part and or, so it should read any aftermarket crash part. On line 6, second page, line 5,
do it again,
you should read aftermarket crash part, you're striking part or.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Schoon.
I would move the amendment as presented.
Move right on.
And these are dash 5. Representative Schoon moves amendments HB 2916A-5. Any discussion? If not, Teresa, call the roll.
Anderson?
Aye.
Ekas?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Schoon?
Aye.
Petit?
Aye.
Chair Jolin?
Aye. The amendments are adopted.
One other amendment, Madam Chair, that Council is presently drafting that I have. I would like you to insert on page 2 after line 27, section 5, following, and then section 5 would become section 6, the effective date. It should say the insurance commissioner may adopt rules to carry out the provision of ORS 746275 to 746300 and 746.991, period. That way it gives him the authority. Apparently, he can deal with insurers, but not the not, for instance, the parts shops. This would give him the authority to write the rules and regulations while we're gone, so that both the insurance companies and the consumers could meet with him and go from there. Otherwise, he does not have the authority, according to Council, to do it.
Madam Chair, would it be appropriate to move that?
Go ahead.
And Council is actually drafting
it. We are drafting them as we speak.
So moved.
Okay, and I'm not going to repeat.
Is that going to read it again?
Just okay. For the record, go ahead.
On page 2, after line 27, insert section 5, make the present section 5 section 6. The new section 5 should read, the insurance commissioner may adopt rules to carry out the provisions of ORS 746.275 to 746.300 and 746.991, period.
Okay, everyone's heard the motion. Any questions or comments? Teresa, please call the roll.
Anderson?
Aye.
Ekas?
Aye.
Petit?
Aye.
Schoon?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Aye. The amendments have been approved.
Move the bill to the floor, please.
Representative Schoon moves the bill to the floor as amended with a due pass.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Been a lot of discussion in this legislative assembly lately, particularly about seat belts and 65-mile limits and whether they might have the potential of being tied together. I'll probably be voting no and serving no as a minority report because this has a great relating clause related to 65-mile-an-hour speed limit.
Okay. Will you please call the roll, Teresa?
Anderson?
No.
Ekas?
Aye.
Petit?
Aye.
Schoon?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Chair Jolin?
Aye. The motion is passed.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
There's no potential. Underlying potential for minority report.
So noted.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Just one note, I have been involved in this bill from the beginning, and I know there's been some concern on part of all of the industry who has watched this. I plan on working with them on the other side to make sure that we find equitable solution to the further issues that may be raised.
Working with or on?
With.
Just wanted to make that perfectly clear. Thank you very much. And Representative Dix will carry the bill.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Representative Vegas.
We might have the same industries do a little work to make sure this bill gets an opportunity to be voted on its own merits and not cluttered with other issues.
Thank you, Representative Vegas. I will close the hearing on HB 2916. We'll open the hearing on Senate Bill 148, Lewis Littlehouse, Department of Commerce.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lewis Littlehouse. I'm with the Department of Commerce. I'm speaking on behalf of Thomas Higashi, Supervisor of the Savings and Loan Credit Union and Consumer Finance Section of the Financial Institutions Division, who's out of town. But I'm hearing this is a bill that came from the Financial Institutions Division. Essentially, this is a housekeeping bill that deals with the updating, clarifying, and reconciling savings and loan credit union and consumer finance sections. You have the testimony. I will touch on each section very briefly, if I may. Section 1 and 2, at the end of last session, Chapter 723 dealing with consumer finance, or excuse me, with credit unions, ended up with three definitions of capital. And that's more than enough. We're proposed to have one, and that's what you find in Section 1. Section 2 deals with the same issue. Section 3 lists the grounds, some of the grounds for refusing to issue a certificate for a credit union. And subsection 2 is a more deals with grounds for getting for removing an officer or director, and I drafted that separately. I deleted the provision and set that forth as a separate section. Section 4 clarifies that credit unions can do individual retirement account transactions. Section 6, Section 5 is an adding section. Section 6 is the is a new section that comes out of the earlier section regarding the power to remove directors, officers, and committee members. Section 7 deals with the definition of capital, and that's deleted because of the new definition in Section 1. Section 8, amending 723.512, goal there is to replace the words guarantee fund with reserves. Now, that amendment did not come through in the bill before you. I have some amendments, which I think you also have, which would make that change. It should read reserves rather than regular reserve. Sections 9 and 10 move specific requirements of existing law requiring the provider of certain services to credit unions be subject to the regulation of the supervisor. Currently, that's in the Bank Act, and the provision is relating at least to credit unions, is moved into the credit union chapter. The next two chapters deal with consumer finance companies. Section 11 is like the change I made for the credit unions, that that moves the provisions relating to removal of officers and directors as a separate section. Sections 12 and 13, or 12, deals with procedures for denial of a license, clarifies, cleans that up. Section 13 deals with changing the location, again, deletes specific procedures and leaves it up to the administrator. Section 14 clarifies existing law in regard to one section now as amended would deal with specifically with the denial of a license. The hearing follows the denial. And the other section deals with the procedure following denial or when a license is proposed to be suspended or revoked. Section 16 is the removal section that's new, stated separately. Section 17 was an amendment that was proposed by the consumer finance industry. It allows different procedures upon payment of a note. The Financial Institutions Division has no objection to that section, to that new section. There is an amendment, however, and essentially there's a transposition of words that occurred, and my amendment would correct that. Section 18 puts in one section what the supervisor is to do with regard when there's a defalcation in a credit union, notice the supervisor, and combines two sections and removes some what appeared to us to be surplusage. Section 19, 725-505, currently refers to consumer finance companies, which should refer to licensees because that term, consumer finance company, is the popularly used term, but it's not statutorily sanctioned. In regard to the last, the repealer, one section dealing with savings and loans, section requiring certain officers to verify documents is deleted. Declaration of intent regarding 1955 intent for the consumer finance companies is deleted. And section that I combined with another is repealed.
Thank you. I want the committee members to note today, look at how empty, I mean relatively empty, the audience area is today. Kind of quiet in here.
Does this mean, Madam Chair, that these bills aren't important?
I don't know. Thank you very much, Lou. Are there any questions or comments? Do we have this noted as possible? John, do you have any questions?
Well,
Representative Sloan?
The volume of the RS that's missing, but it refers to the definition of a financial institution. There's a, on page 4, there's a under section 10, sub 2, sub D, talks about the sale of insurance. I wanted to see if that's a little bit of change on what fits into the definition, because this is pretty broad.
Madam Chair, I have the statutes. Do you want to look?
Why don't you share those? I think there's a certain level of paranoia.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking maybe we could find something that would be beneficial. I don't have any comments to make at this point.
Well, we have this possible work session, don't we?
No.
We didn't.
Probably.
Okay, we're just in here. Okay, there is no further testimony, and we don't have that. It's just public hearing. Okay. So we'll let you investigate, Representative Spoon.
Oh, it's not here. It's 7:46. According to the
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Representative Schoon, I don't think I understood the question.
Okay, on page 4, line 28 and 29. Line 30 specifically says that call it sale of insurance, and it says that the lending institution has the meaning set forth under RS 746-185, and we're missing that column.
I see. I thought you were looking for something in the Bank Act.
I wonder if that has to do with the things that they currently are selling, credit life, et cetera?
I don't know. It could.
We need the answer to that question before we rework this bill. And if you'll provide that for the committee, I would very much appreciate it. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 148. We also have no testimony. We'll open the hearing on Senate Bill 145. And Commissioner Day and Bill Brooks from the Corporation Division, please come forward. It's nice to see you again.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Elaine Day. I'm Corporations Commissioner. And I'm here to testify in support of 145. With me today is Bill Brooks, who is a member of my securities section staff. Bill has been actively involved with this bill since its inception. And Bill is going to do the formal testimony and explanation of the bill for you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Brooks, and I'm a senior securities examiner with the Corporation Division. And I have to say that I'm pleased that there are no audience here today, because at least to me that indicates that there is no opposition to this bill.
You never know. Never say never.
Let me first describe the problems addressed by the bill, then I'll talk about how the bill addresses those problems. The problems with boiler rooms, which operate out of California, Florida, Las Vegas, and other high-life places where the sun shines. Con men spend hours dialing unsuspecting victims, including Oregon residents, either with long-distance cold calls or on leads furnished by responses to attractive ads in local and national newspapers. What is their pitch? They're selling gold or some other precious metal or commodity, usually an item that the public knows by the media that the price is going up on. I refer you to Exhibit A, which is on the last page of the public testimony. And as you can see, Bannister Brighton Limited, they usually pick a nice quality sounding name, is offering gold, silver, or platinum. A typical telephone presentation on this advertisement would be something in the nature of the following. With as little as $1,500 down, you can control $10,000 worth of gold. At $425 an ounce, that would be about 23 ounces. Therefore, for every $10 an ounce that the price goes up, you make $230. If this occurs in 1 month, it translates into 180% return on your investment. Pretty nice. We have inside information that the price is about to shoot up. You better hurry. We'll send a messenger to collect your money. The investors are led to believe that he's purchasing X number of dollars worth of gold for a 15% down payment. The balance to be due over a long period of time, so that he won't have any immediate payments to be putting out, interest payable, but the investor will be able to sell out very shortly and make huge profits due to the rapid rise in the price of gold. He's told that the gold is stored in special facilities that the firm has developed deep in the earth in Nevada or in a special vault, just whatever place. The average investor who bites on this will send in something between $5,000 and $10,000, and sometimes much more. What is the catch? The firm has no gold. The investor's fortunes, his risk, his gamble don't depend on a rise in the price of gold. He can't win because the money is simply gone. The con man has taken it. The deal has no substance.
If I may, just for a moment, this bill has no relationship to, let me give you an example, if I go to some local folks in my community and I want to buy silver or gold or whatever, would this have a relationship to those kinds of transactions?
Madam Chair, it could.
It could.
If there was no delivery in 28 days or if there was no delivery to a depository within 7 days.
So they have to honor the agreement, or they could be in trouble. Yeah, that makes sense.
These carmen are experts at stringing the investor along. As long as the price is rising, they have a little difficulty. If the price starts to fall, the investor might get a fresh tip and roll his investment into some other hot commodity. The string along continues until the complaints start and publicity ensues. The carmen pick up and move to another location. In the meantime, they've taken thousands. In 1982, testimony at congressional hearings estimated losses in commodity investment fraud schemes at $200 million. In 1984, that figure had grown to $1
billion. And was that in Oregon or in the United States?
In the nation,
okay.
Madam Chair. There are two current regulatory efforts, one federal and one state. Congress passed the Commodity Exchange Act and created an enforcement agency, and the Commodities Future Trading Commission, that was the enforcement agency. In 1974, Congress also created, under the guidance of the CFTC, the National Futures Association, which is a self-regulatory organization very similar to the NASD that plays a role in the securities field. The CFTC requires all futures trading to be conducted on approved exchanges, such as the Chicago Board of Trade, the Chicago Mercantile, or the New York COMEX. The CFTC primarily regulates transactions that occur on these exchanges. Legitimate trading has historically developed to be a pricing mechanism for farm products, such as pork bellies, cotton, wheat, and soybeans. The federal law specifically does not cover forward delivery contracts, that is, the purchase of specific commodities to be delivered in the future. The crooks claim that they're outside of the federal law because they're not selling the futures contracts that are regulated. The CFTC, in its enforcement effort, has a couple of people in Los Angeles to protect the West Coast. While we get some help, they don't touch the total problem. The CFTC is also trying, without success, to get the media to stop running these kind of advertisements. At the state level, the Corporation Division has been attempting to deal with these frauds under existing securities laws. However, it's difficult to prove that the purchasers are making an investment as opposed to purchasing commodity. The evidence is simply in the state where the boiler room is operating.
If I may again, pardon me. You mean that newspapers that are aware of the fact that potential ads in their publications are fraudulent are going ahead and publishing them anyway?
Madam Chair, the CFTC is indicating that on a national basis, unfortunately, the media, the print media, are taking a very lax approach to printing these kinds of advertisements. That's true. We do have a special relationship with the Oregonian, and we are hopeful that with this law on the books, we will be able to work with the Oregonian and the other Oregon newspapers and from a local point of view, do better than what the CFTC has been able to do on the national level.
Just further on that same line, and I don't know whether this vehicle would be appropriate, but couldn't there be language drafted to address that and say that if a publication knowingly publishes an article that is fraudulent, that they are penalized?
Well, Madam Chair, we believe that the fraud language in the bill, I believe, includes aider and abettor, and we might be able to make that claim if we were bold enough to go after them.
Sure. Representative Anderson.
What relationship do commodity contracts have, if any, to selling of securities, stock issues, this type of thing? And I guess I bring that up in that there is yet to be made a final decision by this body whether the Secretary of State's involved or whether the Attorney General's office is involved or the interrelation situations there of where the Corporation Commissioner is going to end up, all those issues. Is there anything in this bill that would, what's the word, screw up the process? Okay.
Yeah.
The answer is yes. Do you want them to?
My answer is there is nothing in this bill, Madam Chair, that will reflect on the decisions of the dispersal of the Department of Commerce and the Corporation Division.
Please continue to tweet.
Senate Bill 145 does attack this problem head on. It says no delivery, illegal contract. The bill comes from the Model Code, Model Commodity Code, that is, that was developed by the North American Securities Administrators Association, NASA. It has been adopted in Missouri, New Mexico, and only recently, I believe in February, in the state of Washington, and is pending in several other states. Senate Bill 145 has the support of the CFTC and the NFA as a part of a national coordinated effort to crack down on this problem. In summary, the code makes it illegal to sell commodities unless they are excluded or exempt from the ban. The exemptions are, one, commodity contracts lawfully sold under the Commodities and Exchange Act, two, contracts sold by persons registered with the CFTC, three, contracts between true producers and consumers or end users of the commodity, otherwise referred to as ordinary commercial contracts, four, contracts providing for actual delivery of the commodity to the purchaser within 28 days, or there's a special provision for 7-day delivery to an approved depository in the case of precious metals. And five, contracts where the purchaser is a financial institution or an insurance company. The bill adopts provisions paralleling the Oregon securities law for the administrative, civil injunctive, and criminal sanctions. What is the effect of this bill? The bill will give the Corporation Division an arrow in its quiver. We will be able to advise Oregon residents that these contracts are illegal. We will be able to issue cease and desist orders quickly and publicize those orders. And we may even, as I indicated, be able to dissuade newspapers and other media from running the ads in the first page. In addition to this testimony, I have submitted a section-by-section analysis of the provisions, and I could review those or answer any further questions you might have.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Trying to review my current history, it seems to me not been too many years back that I believe it was Columbia Coin Company in Portland became involved in selling gold coins, bullion, silver coins, and so on, and was unable to produce those in a real brouhaha. Would that type of activity be prevented by this bill?
It would not be prevented, Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, that type of activity would not be prevented. However, Columbia would have been required to either deliver the coins within 28 days or within 7 days if they are precious metals, put them in a depository and provide a receipt that they are in fact there.
My understanding, Madam Chair, was that people were led to believe that they were on deposit in the vaults of the coin company, and I guess from that standpoint, this would correct that.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, I believe that's correct.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there further questions? We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 145 and open the hearing on Senate Bill 88. This is going to be a short day, folks, and I'm glad. Everybody looks tired today. It's amazing. Stressful morning, perhaps? Thank you very much.